afternoon at third case and last for a month, 078P 1114-15 CR State versus Johnson. Attorney Meredith Ross arguing on behalf of Johnson. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Meredith Ross from UW Law School's Frank Remington Center, and I'm here representing Landis Johnson. 30 years ago in Klimas versus State, this court ruled that the Equal Protection Clause is violated when an indigent defendant ends up serving more time than a wealthier defendant based on pretrial custody. The court concluded that the remedy for that was to give credit for that pre-sentence custody and invited the legislature to pass a statute that could be focused on indigency or could even be broader. This legislature did that in passing section 973.155. The construction of the statute argued by the state in this case does not comport with the Equal Protection Clause underpinnings of this statute. The Klimas Court noted that a statute cannot deny what the Constitution mandates. I'd like to make two basic points about what I think the rules are governing sentence credit and then apply them to this case. The first is that sentence credit shouldn't be that hard. It can be factually difficult, but the law shouldn't be that hard. Sentence credit moves a sentence earlier, or at least it moves a start date earlier on a sentence, in order to give the defendant custody for time spent in custody. Sentence credit does not have anything to do with the sentence. If you're a bad person who did a bad thing, you should get a longer sentence, but that doesn't affect the credit in the case. I did hear this morning in the oral argument in the Carter case some confusion about when a court can consider sentence credit, and I would note that in State versus Walker, 117 West 2nd 579, this court ruled that a court must impose sentence first and then determine sentence credit. So that's the first point, is that sentence credit should be simple. It shifts the credit, or it shifts the beginning of the sentence earlier to when the defendant actually entered custody. The second point is that the touchstone in interpreting 973.155 should be the Equal Protection Clause. Would a wealthier defendant and a poorer defendant serve the same amount of time given the imposition of the same sentence? And again, I'd like to jump back very briefly to this morning's oral argument. There was some discussion of the federal sentence credit statute, and Chief Justice Abrahamson asked a question about whether there had been some equal protection challenges to that statute. The federal sentence credit statute states that a defendant gets custody credit under certain circumstances if this credit has not been granted on any other sentence. However, in interpreting that statute, the Fifth Circuit, in a 30-year-old case called Willis, 438 F. 2nd 923, ruled that if the federal sentence is longer than the state sentence, the custody must be granted on the federal sentence, notwithstanding the language of the statute. And that Willis rule, as it's called, has actually been moved into a Bureau of Prisons program statement. So the Federal Bureau of Prisons program statement, for what it's worth, is 5880.28 sub 2 sub C. My point is that you have a language of a statute, but the statute must be interpreted consistent with the Equal Protection Clause. I'd like to apply that to this case.
Yes. For just a minute. Could you give me, it was 439 Fed Sup, and what was the page?
It was 438 Fed Second 923.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Do you want the program statement too?
No, just that.
That was
okay.
Good.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, what I'd like to do is apply what we sometimes call the Bill Gates rule. If Bill Gates were in a Landis Johnson situation, committed exactly the same crimes under exactly the same circumstances, how much time would he serve? And the fact is that in this circumstance, Bill Gates would serve exactly 1 year, because he would have bonded out on his first case, and when he picked up the second case, he would have had the resources to bond out on the second case. In Landis Johnson, spent a year plus 46 days. And that is not consistent with the Equal Protection Clause. contrary to the state's argument in its briefs, the Wisconsin courts, and this court in particular, have read 973-155 more broadly than the state argues. And sometimes that's a situation where the court reads the statute broadly to deny credit, that is, in a situation where strict application of the plain language of the statute would give somebody a windfall, and I'm thinking of the Betcher case, Morick, and Jackson. But there are other situations where the court has construed the statute broadly to grant credit to make sure that a poor person doesn't spend more time in custody than a rich person. And the most recent case in this court was Floyd. Floyd did not talk about the clause of 973-155 that the state focuses on in its brief. Floyd talked about a separate clause which states that a defendant in 973-155 sub 1 sub A can get credit for confinement related to an offense for which the offender is ultimately sentenced. In Floyd's case, this court found that that clause was ambiguous on the facts of his case, and then looking at the case found that where the credit had been connected with a case where that had been dismissed and read in, that it was related to the case of conviction and the sentence imposed, which was Floyd's reckless endangering case. Otherwise, Floyd would not get credit at all. And applying the rule of lenity, this court granted credit to Floyd. The state's argument in the Floyd case was exactly the same argument that it makes in this case. And I would argue that in the situation where you have a judge in a single hearing imposing concurrent sentences at the same time, the confinement on one case is always related to the confinement on the other case because the judge knows all the facts of all the cases. And the judge is making a determination of a disposition. The judge in this case could have given consecutive sentences, could have made one sentence considerably longer than the other, but chose not to. The judge in this case gave 3 one-year custody sentences, but only gave credit on 2 of them.
Counsel?
Yes.
What, if anything, is the relationship between this case and the Carter case we heard this morning? I know they both talk about Ward, and everybody has his or her own interpretation of Ward. So what's the relationship between these two cases, and what does Ward tell us about anything?
All right. I would interpret the state sentence. I think the rules are actually fairly simple, and I think the Tuescher court lays them out pretty clearly. Tuescher says if the cases are consecutive, the sentences are consecutive, you only get the credit once. So it really doesn't matter which case the credit is assigned on. Tuescher says if the sentences are concurrent and imposed at the same time, then time spent in pre-sentence custody is credited toward each sentence. Doesn't talk about whether they have to be in connection with the offense. Tuescher cites Ward.
Does Tuescher deal with the statute? The statute does say that.
Tuescher cites Ward interpreting the statute.
But Ward never interprets in connection with. First of all, we know from the briefs that there was an agreement on Ward not to deal with that issue. So the Ward case can't be read for doing anything with that issue. And as far as Tuescher is concerned, does it address that issue?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Okay.
Tuescher cites Ward in, again, with sentences imposed at the same time. You're correct. It doesn't talk about in connection with, and it doesn't seem to impose an in connection with requirement. Tuescher goes on to distinguish concurrent sentences that are imposed at different times. And in that case, Tuescher says the statute grants custody credit so long as the pre-sentence custody is connected with the course of conduct for which sentence is imposed, again citing to Ward. So Tuescher says there are two different situations here, sentences imposed at a single time, sentences imposed at different times. Tuescher does say Ward and Tuescher allows for dual credit on sentences imposed at different times if the sentence is in connection with both of the sentences, if the custody is in connection with both of the sentences. So I do think that I see Ward as a single sentence imposed at the same time case. let me go on to say what I understand to be the state's interpretation of the statute, and I have to admit after this morning I'm a little confused, but this is my understanding. I think the state is trying to limit the sentence credit granted in two different ways. First of all, in this case, for sentences that are imposed at the same time in a single hearing, that a state is saying the defendant only gets it on concurrent sentences imposed at one time if the custody is factually in connection with all the sentences. That's what this, though.
Say that again, what the state is saying.
The state's argument,
as you understood,
as I understood it, and actually as argued in this case in the Court of Appeals, was when sentences are imposed in a single proceeding at the same time and they're concurrent, the defendant gets credit only if the sentence is in the custody is in connection with all the sentences. That wasn't my reading of Ward. That's not the argument I'm making for you today. But to answer the Chief Justice's question, I think the state is, in Carter, is trying to impose a second limitation, which is they're saying if the sentences are imposed at different times, even if the custody is in connection with both the sentences, the defendant only gets credit on one sentence. So they're saying the Ward rule, as we understand it, is limited to sentences imposed in a single proceeding.
So you never have to get to whether it's even the same conduct, because once you get them at different times, the end.
That's the end of the story.
That's why it's written the way it was.
This is not my case. I don't think that's consistent with Tuscher and Yannick, but obviously you decide your own interpretation of the statute. And again, I would note that in Willis, notwithstanding very clear language in the sentence credit statute saying you never get credit if the custody credit was granted on any other sentence, the federal courts have said, no, that's not true if the federal sentence is the controlling sentence, because otherwise the defendant effectively doesn't get credit for that custody and serves more time.
You know, in a case that talks about two federal sentences rather than a federal and a state?
I will tell you what Willis says. I think Willis actually talks about that. If you'll hold on for a sec.
Okay, thanks.
Willis. Actually, I take that back. This is the Bureau of Prisons program statement, and I'm not sure it's helpful. It says prior custody credits shall be given for any time spent in non-federal pre-sentence custody that begins on or after the date of the federal sentence up to the date that the first sentence begins to run, federal or non-federal. So it only talks about federal and state custody. But I can't answer that.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I'd like to come back to the intriguingly named Bill Gates rule, and which is a colorful and good way of summing up the principle that the wealthy ought not be treated more favorably because of that status. But in this instance, is it not correct to observe that Johnson posted, the defendant in this matter, posted bail on August 13 of 2004? So, and he remained free on that bail.
Your Honor, what happened in this case, and I think that actually Mr. Johnson's factual situation is a very good example of the kind of problems and fortuity that occur in sentence credit cases. You're correct. He was arrested in August of 2004. 4 days later, he posted $1,000 cash bail. Pleads guilty in November. There's a sentencing hearing scheduled for February that is adjourned. We don't know why. He was at the hearing, but it got adjourned. Time goes on. He commits the new offense in April, and the judge at that time posts a $15,000 cash bond.
On the new case.
On the new case.
Leaving unaffected the bond that he had already posted on the old court.
So the old case, the bond on the old case is never revoked. He's got a $15,000 cash bond. The record is very scanty, but it's exactly the same crime as he had committed back in August of 2004. It's possession of marijuana with intent to deliver. There is a bail jumping charge imposed, so at least one can perhaps conjecture that the $15,000 bond is related.
You say same crime, but I think you mean same charge.
Same offense.
Okay.
That's great. Same charge. Time goes on. There's a sentencing hearing again scheduled in the old case that got adjourned. The record indicates that the defendant was in custody, not present. Eventually, the bond on the new case was lowered to $5,000, and he was able to post bond on that case. So the question is, yes, he had enough money to post the $1,000 bond back in 2004. He didn't have enough money to post a $15,000 bond in 2005.
Well, how is he being penalized on the stat on the basis of wealth or lack of wealth because he was by not getting credit relating back to the 2004 case?
Because in this situation, the judge imposed a total sentence of a year on the cases.
So really your argument isn't the application of the Bill Gates rule, so to speak, or the equal protection. It has more to do with an advancement of what Ward has been summarized as saying.
I guess I would disagree, Your Honor, because you say it relates only back to the 2004 case, but the reason he sat in custody on the 2005 case was because he couldn't afford to get out. Bill Gates would have gotten out. He wouldn't have had to worry about sentence credit.
Isn't Mr. Johnson, though, seeking credit for the 50 days on the 2004 case?
He is.
But he posted bond on it.
He posted bond on that, and I let me back up a little bit and try to, again, just the Chief Justice asked a question about how does this all work, which seems like a very fair question. 973-155 has three separate clauses in the first paragraph, and this court has interpreted each of those clauses differently. The first clause is that a convicted offender shall be given credit for all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed.
That's the statute.
You are correct that the courts in the Court of Appeals in Beiersdorf and apparently adopted by this court in Floyd say that requires a factual connection with the custody. So the fact that he's out on bond means that it's not factually connected with the custody on the 2004 case. There are two other clauses in that paragraph, however. I'll jump to the last clause, which says, or for any other sentence arising out of the same course of conduct. Again, this court has ruled that that clause is talking about lesser included offenses. So in other words, he's charged with first degree reckless homicide, spends time in custody, he pleads to second degree reckless homicide, he should get credit for that. And that clause, I should say not this court, Boettcher and Tuescher have both interpreted that clause as meaning it's really limited to lesser-included offenses. There is a third clause that talks about confinement related to an offense for which the offender is ultimately sentenced. And in Floyd, even though the defendant's confinement was on a charge that was ultimately dismissed, it was clearly not in connection with the sentence imposed, as this court has interpreted that phrase, the court nevertheless gave him credit, and the idea was that Mr. Floyd shouldn't have to serve on a five-year sentence, shouldn't have to serve 5 years plus 157 days. My argument here is that that rule, which you limited to read-ins, and in Floyd the court distinguished read-ins from dismissed charges, acquittals, pending charges, other stuff like that. If it applies to read-ins, it's a mystery to me why it wouldn't apply to a case where you've already pled guilty in the same proceeding and you're being sentenced in a single proceeding. Clearly, the judge in sentencing Mr. Johnson on his 2004 case was taking into account all the conduct underlying his 2005 case because the judge was sentencing him in a single proceeding.
Isn't it fair to say, though, that it would be just as clear that the judge setting bond would have followed the statutes by considering the resources of the defendant? So if Mr. Gates was sitting at the table, perhaps the bond would have been something much higher, perhaps with another digit or two. So I don't see. I guess I'm having a problem seeing how this is, especially with the disconnect between the 2004 being posted, bond having been posted, and then trying to get credit from the 2005. I'm having difficulty seeing this as an equal protection.
Let me address the sort of another way of looking at this, because I do see it as eating. I think he was able eventually to scrape together the $1,000 in the 2004 case, but he wasn't able to scrape together $15,000. We know that because he had to get his bond lowered to try to get out. But let's assume that his lawyer on his 2005 case said, gee, you know, he's got this cash bond on the 2004 case. I better go do something about it.
Right.
you know, as I mentioned in my briefs, I have some question, and that's basically the argument that dissent made in this case, was that there was an ineffective assistance of counsel claim because the lawyer should have gone back and addressed the issue. I think there's a lot of huge complexities in that. You may not have the same attorney. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on. But let's assume that his lawyer in his 2005 case said, I want to go back and try to do something about his bond on the 2004 case. If it's a signature bond, that's a pretty easy thing to do. You can go back and you can ask the judge to convert it to a dollar cash bond, and that'll do it. If it's a cash bond, I'm not sure exactly how you do it. Do you go back and say, revoke his cash bond and forfeit it? Do you ask that the judge raise the cash bond by a dollar? I guess what I'm suggesting is that's the state's suggested resolution of this case, I think, and I think it causes a huge amount of problems in the court system. It's one more pretrial hearing. Let's assume the judge actually does, or the defense attorney asks for revocation of bond or modification of bond. What if it takes a month to get a hearing on that case? You know, what's his bond status in that situation? And, you know, this was a Milwaukee case, and I can tell you that there's a lot of delay in Milwaukee cases.
I presided over misdemeanor court in Milwaukee County, but I don't think that does anything to detract. How does that take away from the fact he had posted the cash bond? He's getting credit for the time he served on it, and why should he get credit for something that he was out on bond for?
I guess maybe where you and I are looking at it differently is you're saying, we've got three sentences, and he shouldn't get credit on the third sentence because it wasn't factually in connection with. I'm saying we have a total sentence, and that's the way the jury instructions read, of 1 year concurrent on all these three cases, and that the custody and the behavior on the 2005 case was related to the sentence imposed on the 2004 case, which is what Floyd says. I'd like to mention one other case that actually comes to the same conclusion, and that's this court's case in Gilbert. I don't want to go into too much detail on Gilbert, but the defendant was placed on probation on two different counts. He got 30 days of condition of probation time on one and 60 on the other. Eventually, he's revoked, and he gets concurrent sentences imposed at the same time. The legal issue in Gilbert was, do you get credit for condition of probation time? This court said yes. But this court ruled that the case should be remanded, that he get credit on his sentences, plural, as requested. What he requested was 60 days. And if you think again, technically, if he only had 30 days of condition of probation time on case one and he had 60 days on case two, he shouldn't get 60 days on both sentences. But this court, in a situation where the defendant got concurrent sentences at the same time, said the defendant's motion should be granted. And that was a motion for 60 days of custody.
So, in this case, it's quite clear, I think, that you have three different defenses. Right?
I'm sorry?
Three different defenses.
Who
he's charged with and sentenced to.
Oh, I see. Yes, yes.
And he spends 4 days in confinement with regard to one offense, right? And he spends 50 days of confinement in regard to the second offense. And apparently he spends no days in confinement to the third offense.
Actually, he spends 50 days on both of the second.
All right. Doesn't matter, though, in the example. Doesn't matter. And what happens to him is he gets 4 days credit for the first offense, 50 days credit for the second and third offense, and applies the language of the statute that says the sentence has to be in connection with the offense. So far, so good, right?
Right.
Can't complain about that. Problem comes up that, if I understand your argument, the statute also says that you shall receive credit for every day spent in jail, or in confinement, I should say. And unless you give him credit for all three offenses, when you have concurrent sentences, as you do in this case, all on the same day, right? If you don't give him credit for all for the 54 days.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And give him credit for 54 days, you have violated the second part of the statute because he has more than, sorry, what was the sentence here? The total sentence. Doesn't matter.
Oh, a year.
A year. We can use the 12 months.
Right.
So he doesn't really get credit because the judge sentenced him to a maximum of 12 months, right?
Yes.
He's supposed to get credit on his sentence for all time spent. If you don't give him credit on all of it, he is going to serve more than 12 months. That's the essence of your argument.
That's the essence of my argument. My time is out. I do have one quick response.
Make it fast.
My thinking has evolved on this. When I filed the original motion and in the Court of Appeals, basically I said he should get 50 days on both sentences to
be effectuated. I was going to ask you about the 4 days.
And I think the idea was that Ward, which we were relying on, talks about implementing the concurrent sentence, and I was thinking, okay, you take the sentence with the largest amount of credit. But my colleagues have convinced me that, in fact, he spent 54 days in custody, and he ought to get credit for 54 days.
And if you don't do that, you're not true to the second aspect of that. And I also just figured that, as the state said this morning, the 2 days between the Illinois arrest and the Wisconsin arrest is de minimis. The state's not going to fuss about that, and you aren't going to fuss about the 4 if you got the 50. But theoretically, if you're going to follow that argument, you ought to get 54 days. But it seems to me that the circuit court emphasized the first sentence in the statute, and you're emphasizing both and trying to make them consistent.
I'm emphasizing the second clause.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. McGee, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Good afternoon, Ms. McGee.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to get right to the heart of what I believe is the issue in this case, and that is that I believe that Mr. Johnson is trying to eliminate that portion of the statute that requires that credit be given only if the two sentences, which are three sentences that we have here, arises in connection with the sentences for which that are ultimately imposed. And I think that actually eliminates looking at the clause in connection with as the controlling situation in this particular case.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have three sentences. All of the sentences are imposed all at the same time. But as a matter of fact, on one of the sentences in the 2004 case, the gentleman was still on bail. And we have cases that reflect that even though technically he was in custody, with respect to the 2004 case, he was actually still free on the 2004
case. He did have 4 days. You agree with
Pardon?
You agree with the 4 days?
Yes. With respect to that particular case. Yes, with respect to the 200. I haven't emphasized that in my brief because it gets a little even more complicated than it already is when you're talking about those periods of time. The position that the state is taking is that the statute clearly requires that if the period of custody for which the defendant seeks credit was a period of time connected to the course of conduct for which the sentence was ultimately imposed, then they get credit. In this case, they did not. The pretrial custody was not in connection with the 2004 case.
Suppose it had been in connection with two different crimes, but same time, sort of like the Carter case. Suppose he was in jail on two charges that were very different.
Of what?
Two charges that were very different.
And the pretrial custody was in connection with
one of
having
those.
With just one of them? then he'd only get the custody on that one. If he were in custody for both charges, I shouldn't go on to that particular scenario, but in this particular case, the two cases were, the pretrial custody was not in connection with, and I think that that's the main concern that we have here. I believe the problem has arisen, and I think the court looked at that this morning, is the Ward case. The Ward case seems to say that if the custody is in connection with the sentence ultimately imposed or is imposed on the same day, et cetera. I'm sorry.
Ms. McGee, sorry. As to the second charge, he was arrested in the 2005 case and charged with two crimes, new drug offense and bail jumping, right?
Mm-hmm.
How long did he stay in confinement on those cases?
I believe that was 50 days on both of those cases.
So are you going to give him 50-day credit on both counts, one and two, that is both the drug offense and bail jumping?
Yes, and that's indeed what was done.
So he was in jail for two reasons, and you're going to give him on both?
Because they were in connection with the same course of conduct for which he was ultimately sentenced.
The bail jumping was violating the bond in the 2004 case, which is unrelated to the 2005 case. So I don't think it's the same course of conduct.
Not necessarily the same course of conduct, but he was in pretrial custody because of that charge and the other charge, the two counts.
But wasn't his bail jumping charge because he was selling drugs again? So he was really incarcerated for the course of conduct of selling drugs, and he got two counts because of that course of conduct.
Well, I think the issue basically is the fact that they were in connection with, and I would focus on that particular phrase that I believe is the issue.
You're saying that because the bail jumping count was in connection with the matter for which he was being sentenced that day, therefore he should get 50 days credit for both that count and the actual sale from that file.
And I don't think that anybody's... You know, from the circuit court to the court of appeals, that has not been something that has been a focus of this agreement, as I understand it.
But that's accurate to say. That's a complete response to the previous question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm asking a question mark.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. McGee, how do you respond to what I heard from opposing counsel about this is a huge violation of equal protection? Unless you give the full credit on both concurrent sentences. What's your response to that?
I'm not exactly sure what the situation he's... I'm not exactly sure that the facts here reflect that he's not... The sentences, the offenses were two different offenses. They are two different factual offenses. They carry two different potential penalties. This would not be a situation where he would not necessarily be subject to longer penalties regardless of the situation. I think the issue as far as in connection with, it's a problem with, and this is the part that's really, I think, conceptually difficult, and that is, what happens to these sentences? Oh, I know I can't get away from that. From the microphone. What happens to these sentences when they are imposed and the credit is given and one moves back and the other one moves forward and so forth? But if your question is, if there are two charges here, and he was able to get out on one and not on the other. Could you give me an example of what situation?
I understood her argument to be the Bill Gates rule, and that what you've got here is a violation of equal protection unless you give full credit on the sentences in the first case and the second case. And I also understood her to read a provision other than the in connection with in the statute as justifying her position. And I'm asking you, how do you respond to these arguments?
Okay. Say this gentleman was unable to make bail, and he was in custody, and then only got custody on the one case, got pretrial confinement credit on the one case, and not the other. Bill Gates, if he's out on both of them, and then gets sentenced, he's going to be serving that sentence all the way through to the end, because he's not getting any pretrial custody credit on both sentences, because he's out on both sentences.
Ms. Justice Cooks, looks like you were going to
ask.
Two things. Number one, do you disagree with the premise of your opposing counsel that the legislative history reflects that the origin of the statute is based on equal protection concerns?
No, I certainly agree with that. Absolutely.
So that is to the origin, the purpose,
right.
When I say origin, let me use a better term of art.
Yes.
The purpose of the statute is to effectuate equal protection in sentencing.
Right.
And okay. Second question. Now, I sit here, as I did this morning, and as I did in preparing for these cases and reading the myriads of cases that you need to read in order to show up here. And all I can say is keep it simple.
Well,
I have this fear that our calendar next year is going to have three cases the first week on pre-sentence, on custody credit. And so the Tuckshire case is one case that can be read for this kind of premise. Tell me what's wrong with it. Consecutive, you only get it on one, right? And I'm talking, when I say you get it on one, I mean credit for being in custody. Okay. So, consecutive, you get it on one. Concurrent at the same time, you get it concurrently on those there's a concurrent sentence. I'm a judge, I say, okay, I'm imposing a year on this robbery, and I'm imposing a year on this drug offense. The years are to be concurrent. We serve. So you get it when it's at the same time, you get the same credit for each. Now when you get it on different dates, different sentencing times, then the custody credit is given only if, as the Tuckshire case says, the custody is in connection with the sentence that was imposed. That's real simple. Consecutive, only one. Concurrent at the same time, on the ones that are concurrent. Concurrent at different times, only get custody if, according to the words of the statute, the custody is in connection with the course of conduct for which a sentence was imposed. What's wrong with that? And that's a reason that Tuckshire, as I understand it, Tuckshire, did it that way. And what's wrong with that? There are a variety of interpretations. We can pick a couple of interpretations and we can do all sorts of stuff with this. But why can't we just keep it with a reasonable interpretation that is simple?
I think that the interpretation that's been given here is not simple, because it seems to me that if the legislature has said that you're only going to get credit if the period of custody is in connection with the sentence ultimately imposed, then that's what the statute says. And if we're looking at statutory interpretation, we're trying to apply the statute.
I know, and cases have interpreted this statute differently. No, pick a case.
Pick a case. I'd like to talk about Ward, if that's okay.
Okay. I was talking about the Tuckshire case, but we can talk about the Ward case, you know. But whatever case we talk about, let's keep the answer simple.
Well, it seems with the facts that we have here that, if we look at the distinguishing features of Ward, as set by the Court of Appeals, and accept that the language that's been relied on from Ward is actually just dicta. And as Justice Gableman mentioned this morning, and the Court of Appeals mentioned, as it turned out, the state had conceded that it was in connection, the course of conduct was in connection, all three of them. So therefore, Ward doesn't really have anything to say. You asked if Ward had anything to say.
Assuming that Ward is not dicta, assuming we don't do dicta here, is your argument the same?
To say that it's not dicta? Mm-hmm. Well, I would have to stick with my argument that it didn't go there. Ward just didn't go there because it didn't have the facts, the actual facts before it at the time. Unfortunately, it relied on some language from the special materials from the jury instructions committees that perhaps wasn't exactly really carefully considered, and thereby made some statements that might not necessarily follow the statute. But as a matter of fact, the facts that are required to reach the conclusion that's been reached, and that I am saying that Ward didn't actually address, those facts weren't there. Now, whether or not you asked this morning whether or not the state should have conceded, or you know whether that was the proper thing to do, I don't know. But as a matter of fact, because that happened, the issue wasn't before the Ward court. And as you know from the briefs that have been filed, courts have looked at things differently in different ways in interpreting that Ward language. But if it's recognized, as the Court of Appeals recognized, that it didn't really address that particular issue, then it's much easier to say that the in connection with language has to be observed at all times when you're looking at
it. One of my problems with Ward is in the briefs that, you know, they, as you indicated, not only agreed that they get concurrent, the three concurrent sentences for the marijuana charge, that they get credit for that pre-sentence custody, but they also gave it the same, the days were credited to a totally separate offense that was sentenced by another judge 2 days earlier. You know, they all got credit for that, too, in Ward. So.
Well, I think that just shows that Ward needs a closer look.
Is that what it shows? I think keep it simple is what it shows.
Yeah.
The Court of Appeals decided Ward. Wasn't in fact obvious to everyone involved that it involved the same underlying conduct or conduct that was in connection with the matters for which Ward was being sentenced?
I think that's what the Court of Appeals
can you reconcile, can you think of any logical way to reconcile the plain language of the statute with the way that Ward has been interpreted to mean that if perhaps by luck of the draw or luck of the clerk's draw or random chance of when cases are scheduled, whether they be in Milwaukee County or any other county, that credit be given for all of them, as opposed to the poor unlucky person who gets one sentence 1 month and then another sentencing date a couple of months down the road? Is there any way to reconcile that, what you referred to earlier as dicta, and I think reasonable minds can hold differing positions on whether that part is dicta, but I think what it goes to is the heart of the question is whether there's a way to reconcile that language with the plain language of the statute.
To reconcile that particular language?
Yes.
I'm not sure about it, whether or not it can be reconciled or not. I am sure that the facts that would permit that that particular interpretation weren't before the court. And that is, and also that, as I said before, I know the special materials and the special materials relating to the jury instruction also need to be taken a look at, and I believe that the Court of Appeals suggested that that happen, and I'm authorized to say that it's my understanding that the Jury Instructions Committee is going to be looking at it. It's been many, many years since these particular special materials and jury instructions have been looked at.
Also, one of the things maybe we can accomplish in this opinion,
yes,
is to, like the Court of Appeals, and actually I'm thinking of an earlier case this morning, said, oh, the special materials has some problems. And you just made reference to that. I mean, do you think the special materials has problems? If so, what are the problems and how should we suggest if they are not following the law, how should we, what should we say to them?
I believe that the Court of Appeals in this particular case, I'm not sure if specific suggestions were made by the writer of this opinion. But I think the problem is the conjunctive and disjunctive of either or, which isn't actually in the statute. That was the main thing that was appeared to be a problem. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the decision right now and seeing what the Court of Appeals said. The Court of Appeals went through a huge discussion. Yes, it was suggested there that the disjuncting phrasing does not purport to say, I'm on page 14 of the decision, is an alternative to the requirement that the credit be in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentencing is actually ultimately made. In other words, that was the main problem that was focused on by the Court of Appeals, and that was what they were looking at. In other words, you can't just eliminate the in connection with language from the statute. Everything goes back to what the legislature did when they recognized that there was an equal protection problem here. They enacted this statute, they put certain language into it, and they said that that language obviously has to be followed as it is understood. And so you can't just eliminate the in connection with language.
Okay. Well, in your interpretation and what you're asking for, if it were Bill Gates, would he have spent the same amount of time as Mr. Johnson? When you give the credit the way you want to do it.
Yeah, ultimately.
Well, I don't know what ultimately
is.
I mean, at the end of 12 months, 10 months, I don't care what months, I want to know for these three offenses, does he spend the same time as a person who spent no time in jail?
Yes, because his sentence goes out farther because he wasn't in that custody to begin with.
Does he spend the same time in jail or not? I think he...
Well, if he's sentenced to concurrent sentences, he's going to spend the full year on each sentence, assuming that that's a year.
Sent into concurrent, he'll spend 12 months in jail, okay?
Because he didn't spend any time to begin with.
Mr. Gates would not have spent any time to begin with. Okay. So Gates will spend, poor Mr. Gates, he will spend 12 months in jail. How much time in jail would Mr. Johnson spend calculating the credit the way you are doing?
Well, I guess what you're saying is, because he was... This is where the in connection with.
I don't care what it is. I want to just know. I don't want to know how you get there. I don't know one of the statutes. I just want to know if Mr. Johnson and Mr. Gates will spend the exact same 12 months in jail, recognizing that Mr. Johnson has spent 54 days in jail already.
Which, had they been in connection with.
I understand that. That's the problem. But what's the bottom line? Right.
I assume that you're indicating that because the one sentence got, he would, they wouldn't have both been moved back, right?
Going to spend more than 12 months, the way I calculated. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, it's 50 days. As we were told, lawyers and judges don't do math well. I think he spends more than 12 months. Johnson is more than 12 months when you add up his 54 days. And you're telling me, which is a good position, that's right. It's okay that he spends more than 12 months because of the way the statute is written.
Yeah, I guess that is my position, as opposed to saying that it wouldn't be the same, that it would be the same amount.
And your position is that the statutory language in connection with, this is as I hear your position, your statutory language in connection with trumps the concept that Mr. Gates and Mr. Johnson should be treated the same.
I would have to say, first of all, that this case has not given us the opportunity to actually fully address the issue of equal protection in this situation, where it's a statutory case. But second of all, I think that because it's not a problem with equal protection, because we're talking about two separate situations. We're talking about a situation where he's in prison for a longer period of time because it was the custody wasn't in connection with.
And the statute doesn't allow it.
Let me say that if I have to think about numbers and periods of time off the top of my head this morning or this afternoon, I may have misspoken. But in any event, the issue having to be with whether it's in connection with, that's the bottom line. And I think that's what we've definitely looked at here. The legislature obviously took that into account and determined that if it's not in connection with, it's not going to be an equal protection violation. So I don't think that actually it's a fruitful discussion to talk about situations where that aren't presented.
Doesn't the whole question about the application of Bill Gates' rule and whether Mr. Gates would spend more time in jail under this scenario, doesn't that assume something, and that is Gates would have received the same bond at the 2005 hearing that Mr. Johnson did?
You know, I have to admit, I have a little trouble conceptualizing all of this right off the top of my head. But
well, let me make it easier.
Well, thank you.
In 2004, Mr. Johnson received a certain amount of bond set by a judge, who the judge had to follow the statutes, right? In imposing bond, yes.
Yes.
And part of the statute requires the judge making the bond decision to take into account the apparent financial resources of the one who he or she is imposing bond upon. True?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So doesn't it follow from that a judge following the statutes may have imposed, I say may, have imposed a higher amount of cash bond upon a person in Mr. Gates's financial situation and with his resources and ability to pay, than a judge who was following the statutes may have imposed upon Mr. Johnson, who I presume, because he's represented by the Public Defender's Office, may not have had the resources, the same amount of resources. True?
I would say that would definitely be something that a trial court would look at.
And so, that's not my ultimate question. My ultimate question is, doesn't the whole Bill Gates hypothetical depend on Gates and Johnson getting the same amount of bond set?
So that it would be just as easy for, it would be
so what may seem
different
like,
abilities for them to
what may be. Seem like a very substantial financial amount to Mr. Johnson may not seem quite so substantial to Mr. Gates. And so that a judge may have set a lot higher cash bond on Gates, so therefore Gates may have been in custody too high.
Yes.
We have to set it up high. So that he can't meet it, just like Mr. Johnson can't meet it, to make
right.
it fair and equal.
Right, right.
But to get back on the statute, which is what's troubling me, and I'm not sure where I am on it all yet, when the statute was passed, it was passed in response to someone who couldn't meet bail ending up with a longer sentence for the same crime, right? Had nothing to do with concurrent sentences.
Right.
So it was a one-by-one that the legislature passed, and they said, you know what? If you got a poor guy there, he should get the same sentence as rich guy over here. But it had nothing to do with people who, in quick enough succession, that they are committing multiple crimes, sometimes out of the same course of conduct, sometimes out of many different courses of conduct. That wasn't in the contemplation, as far as you know, was it?
Oh, I certainly have no reason to think that they were doing anything other than just making, you know, looking at a sentence.
Okay, so it was just...
There's nothing that addresses in the statute anything.
Right, no, it doesn't, and that's what's bothering me. We're all on this concurrent sentences for folks that do a lot of things in
right.
a small period of time that violate the law. Sometimes they arise out of the same course of conduct, and sometimes they don't arise out of the same course of conduct.
Right.
And are they similarly situated with the guy that does a bad thing 1 year, and now he's in prison, and you find out that 4 years before he did something else, and so he's charged with that, but really, he's only done two things in 4 years instead of three things in 1 month. There are all sorts of differences.
Yes, that is definitely true, and I think when the Jury Instructions Committee started trying to describe the various scenarios without having, without looking directly at the language of the statute, that they sort of got off base a little bit. And, of course, this court has certainly recognized that the jury instructions are certainly something to look at, but that they're not law, and sometimes they're not exactly right.
Well, so what are we left with? We are left with a statute that doesn't talk about multiple offenses other than same offenses. We're left with a statute that doesn't talk about concurrent, doesn't talk about consecutive, right? Those
right.
words are not in there.
Right.
And what we're left with is a whole bunch of cases from this court and the Court of Appeals that deal with particular fact scenarios. And they may or may not be consistent depending upon how you read the cases and how you read the briefs of the cases. That's what we're left with, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why is the Jury Instruction Committee in any better shape than we are to pull all this apart and come up with something?
That's my point.
That's your point. Well, we got to make a decision in this
right.
case. And so if you were going to write the opinion, Ms. McGee, what would you write that would, at the same time, meet the statutory language meet the equal protection concept, if you think that's important as underlying the language, and reconcile these cases?
I think it would be difficult to reconcile all the cases in a single opinion because all the factual situations are completely all over the board. That's difficult. That's why I think the main thing here is to let people know that Ward is not controlling in the situations that we have here, that it's been used in various ways that perhaps it hasn't actually covered, because it has been. It has been over a period of time, and it has been relied on for both sides and so forth. So that needs to be made clear, I think. And I also think, this is what the Court of Appeals did in terms of making that explanation, and in terms of explaining about the problems with the special materials, that we need to get away from trying to have Ward stand for something that it doesn't really stand for in situations where we have concurrent sentences where the pre-sentence credit did not arise in connection with the sentence that was ultimately imposed.
Well, what about Yannick?
About what?
Yannick, the Yannick case. Yeah, well, I know. I read it.
I think that it, too, does not necessarily address the particular facts of this case.
I know, but the state made the same argument that it has been making.
It did make the same argument.
And lost.
That's
that
true.
Argument.
But I don't think that the court actually addressed this specific argument in the context of the facts of the Yannick case, and I wouldn't say that that was the case that would be controlling in terms of these particular facts.
Okay, so in summary, the statute may not be internally consistent when applied to particular cases, depending on which provisions you're looking at.
And depending on what the facts are.
And what the facts are. The cases are not entirely consistent. And there's no case precisely on point in this case.
To this case?
Yeah, precisely on point. And so the court will just have to make a decision.
And hopefully clarify sentence credit for all the circuit court judges and
you'll agree with
justice
Brad
to keep it simple in this court.
Thank you, Ms. McGee.
Thank you.
Ms. Ross?
I'd like to make
just a few points. One, you know, there's been a lot of focus on the language of the statute, and again, I want to reiterate.
Attorney Ross, can I ask a quick question? I've been troubled by the idea of disparate treatment here that's been raised. And so I've put on my trial court hat, and I'm going back to Washington County where there were four of us sitting there. And under your logic today, if I'm sentencing Mr. Johnson and I have both cases in front of me, he gets 54 days credit, right?
Correct.
Now, if Judge Farragher, or a different judge, is sentencing him on the first case, and I'm sentencing him on the second case, on my case, he gets 50 days credit, and on Judge Farragher's, he gets 4 days credit.
That's correct, and I do think it's a problem, and
treatment in the real world.
Well, I guess there's two ways to respond to that. One is that that's a court-created problem. That is, the courts in Wisconsin have interpreted the in connection with requirement more narrowly than it needs to be. I don't think that has to be resolved to resolve this case, but I want to.
Judge Farragher would never give 50 days credit on a 4-credit case. You just don't make up days or give days that aren't due on your case that's right before you. So that's what's troubling me, because that's a real life scenario of what happens every day in the circuit court. Different cases, different branches, people sentencing people. Sometimes sentences run concurrent, and they don't all give the same amount of credit on every case for which a sentence is running concurrent. So I'm trying to sort that out, because I think that's real disparity that would play out regularly under this scenario. So
the Court of Appeals raised the same issue and argued that it was an equal protection problem, that is, a defendant sentenced on the same day, a defendant sentenced on different days. I agree that unfairness can ensue. However, the bottom line is, I don't think you remedy the problem by taking away Alandis Johnson's credit. I don't see how that helps anyone, frankly, and I also think that you do have a different situation where you're sentencing Mr. Johnson. Not having gotten to the sentence credit determination, you say this total conduct is worth a year in jail. Then you get to the sentence credit determination, and as the Chief Justice pointed out, the question is, does he spend a year in jail like Bill Gates, or does he spend a year plus 46 days?
In my scenario, if I'm sentencing him, I give him the 50 days credit on mine. And then Judge Farragher upstairs would give him 4 days credit.
Right.
And if he decides to run it concurrent, so be it, but Still, he doesn't get 54 days credit.
Each judge sentences separately. I will note that the jury instructions, although they follow this court in saying that in imposing a sentence in a single proceeding, the judge does not consider sentence credit, the jury instructions also say that a judge in imposing a sentence that comes after an earlier sentence can consider credit imposed on that earlier sentence, either, to the benefit or to the detriment.
Can consider it, can't order it.
That's correct. That's correct. And I can think of many scenarios. We have a sentence credit situation that focuses on this in connection with. All I can say is I don't know that it's been argued any other way. If I can just briefly address the statute, the state keeps saying this is a case of statutory construction, and I absolutely agree with that. But the CAT statute must be consonant with the Equal Protection Clause. And I think there's two ways of looking at what I would call the Ward Rule. I do think Ward says exactly what it says it says, but that's neither here nor there. You can decide what you want. And that is, you can either say the Ward Rule is a prophylactic rule that is designed to, sort of notwithstanding the in connection with requirement, is designed to implement the nature of the concurrent sentences. That's one way of looking at this statute. The other way of looking at it is to say we're not looking at the in connection with language of the statute at all. We're looking at the second clause in the statute, which talks about confinement relating to the sentence imposed. And in the unique situation where a single judge is imposing multiple sentences, the judge has made a determination that Alandis Johnson should spend a year in prison. He actually spent a year and 46 days in prison. There's something wrong with that. With regard to Justice Bradley's comment, I agree, keep it simple. And I do think that the rule articulated by Tuescher is a simple rule.
And you think it says what?
I think it says if sentences are consecutive, the defendant gets a credit once. If the sentences are concurrent and imposed on the same day, Tuescher says the credit is applied equally to all the sentences. Doesn't talk about in connection with. If the sentences are concurrent and imposed on different days, the custody must be in connection with each sentence. You know, I agree that problems arise, but I'm not sure you solve those problems by not granting credit in this situation. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Yeah, Ms. McGee, and thank you, Ms. Ross, for your arguments today and a second sentencing credit case that is not more simple than the first one. Thank you. That concludes the hearing in 078-1114, CR State versus Johnson. The court will meet in the conference room and closed session at 10 after.